Good morning. Wow, I'm always surprised at how high up this feels when I get up here. We are looking through the series of Advent and looking at the gifts. We're following along with a book called Rescuing Christmas. It's giving us a different perspective, hopefully giving us some challenging thoughts and ideas around Christmas, different than what might be the prevailing culture of Christmas around gifts and presents and all that going on, probably for most of us right now in our lives. There is copies of this book available in the foyer if you want to follow along with the series, if you want to read ahead and find out what's coming up next, if you want to compare what was said with what was actually written in the book, however you want to go about it. It's a very short, thin book. You can read it through one go. It's very readable and gives us a nice overview. I'll steal Andy's line from last week to see how we get here. He says, "It's not so much we three kings of Orient are, as the song goes, but we indeterminate number of learned ones from somewhere a fair way to the east of Judea." We don't really know lots of things, except there was three gifts, which is good, because that's what we're focusing on in this series. We know for sure there was three gifts. It's written in the verses in Matthew. The book sums it up in one way like this. Gold tells us what we are rescued from. Frankincense tells us what we are rescued for. Myrrh tells us what we are rescued by. The gift of a clean start and myrrh. We had it nicely illustrated just a few minutes ago with giving a nine-year-old boy a pot of shaving cream. But I don't know if anyone here has ever given or received an offensive present. Something was a bit wrong. Before you shout out and get us all in trouble, what happened there, let me just explain. We're not talking about rude or crude presents. I'm not going down that sort of way, because we'll all be recorded and if we're saying that. But what I'm saying is a misjudged present, like giving a nine-year-old shaving cream, like giving someone who has not a single hair on their head a comb. Maybe you thought it was a funny idea at the time, but when they came to open it on Christmas Day, the look on their face told you that was the wrong present for the wrong person at the wrong time. Let's look at another example from a TV show. Can we queue up the video that should hopefully be on there? I don't remember. No, go back a few. There's a video clip separate. You should. Okay. I don't know if anyone knows the Simpsons TV show. I watched it as a kid growing up, and I wanted to be Bart Simpson because he did everything wrong, but he had a great time doing it. Now when I watch The Simpsons, I probably look to Homer Simpson more. He's the dad of the family, if you don't know, and he gets everything wrong. So I think as long as I'm doing better as a father and a husband, as long as I'm doing better than Homer Simpson, I'm doing okay. So let's see what Homer does in this clip in a second. He's forgotten his wife's birthday. He's forgotten his wife's birthday. He went out that morning to buy her a present. It comes to the meal at the evening. He'd gone out for a nice posh family meal, and here's Homer giving his wife the wrong sort of present.
Hold on now. Your mother hasn't opened my present yet.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Miss Homer Simpson. Happy birthday to you.
Don't worry. This frosting will come right up. Beauty, isn't she?
Well, it's hard for me to judge, since I've never bowled in my life.
Well, if you don't want it, I know someone who does.
Good old Homer Simpson. If you didn't quite follow what was going on there, Homer, who loves bowling, had gone out and bought himself a bowling ball. He got his name engraved on it, given it to his wife as a present, and then had the cheek to say, well, if you don't want it, I know someone who does. Not surprisingly, Marge's long-suffering wife is not amused. But she, if you follow on the rest of the episode, she takes that bowling ball, she goes and has bowling lessons and has a great time. And that probably teaches Homer a bit of a lesson. But not to call the three wise men quite the same as Homer Simpson. They weren't deliberately trying to be offensive. But on the surface, they did give a gift, as Christine really demonstrated nicely for us. They did give a gift that had a bit of a strange meaning. Next slide, thanks. I wonder if the conversation went a bit like this. They were saying, right, we'll give him gold and frankincense. They paused dramatically. We'll give him gold and frankincense. Thanks, John. Next slide. But wait. Next slide. There's more. There's myrrh to come. There's myrrh to come. This strange gift. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But wait, there's myrrh to come. It's a bit like going to Mary and Joseph. This is your a gift for your probably 1 or 2 year old child at this time. It's a really vivid reminder that one day he's going to die. Enjoy. That's a bit like what was going on here. It's probably a bit like what it would felt to Mary and Joseph, not being aware of everything, how everything was going to pan out. Myrrh was a liquid used for pain relief in extreme circumstances, for instance, impending death. It was also used for embalming bodies after death. It was pretty clear what myrrh was signifying. And in fact, if we go on, we see this in verses later on in the story of Jesus' death, actually. We see myrrh showing up here. In Mark 15, verses 23 and 24, it says this: "Then they offered him wine." This is the soldiers who put Jesus on the cross. "They offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it, and they crucified him." And then further on in the story from this time, the book of John, he is talking about Joseph of Arimathea. There's two men, and Nicodemus. They wanted to bury the body of Jesus. Nicodemus had brought along with him myrrh, some other spices. They took Jesus' body, wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. So we have the gift of myrrh, which from first look seems a really inappropriate gift. Can you imagine giving the parents of a young child morphine? But it turned out to be the perfect gift. Andy hinted at it a bit last week. Something interesting is going on here. We have these wise men from a foreign land following a star. It all seems a bit strange, yet they turn up at the right place at the right time with these strange gifts, but are the perfect gifts. Because the reality that we don't always think about so much at Christmas, but myrrh really points us in that direction, the reality that Mary and Joseph's child, Jesus, was born to die. It was part of the plan all along. Jesus was sent to save us by dying on the cross for our sins. And of all the gifts, myrrh really highlights this point. It shows the link between Jesus' birth at Christmas and his death at Easter. Another way of thinking about it is Christmas doesn't make sense without Easter. We can't take one without the other. Jesus' birth on its own wasn't enough. It was only by his death on the cross that we can be made right with God. And we'll see it, won't we? If we go to any nativity play, maybe here on this very stage in a few weeks' time, we'll see one of the children will be holding the representation of myrrh, maybe in a bottle or something like that, to give us a sense of the three gifts. It has a deep and significant meaning. And going back to that carol, "We three kings of Orient are," we know that bit has some dubious bits to it. It's not necessarily three, and they might not have been kings. But the fourth verse that talks about myrrh gets it spot on. "Myrrh is mine, its bitter perfume breathes a life of gathering gloom. Sorrowing, sighing, bleeding, dying, sealed in the stone cold tomb." It all seems a bit doom and gloom with myrrh, doesn't it? You're probably thinking, oh, I wish I could have come to the one about gold, or maybe the one at frankincense coming up next week. They sound a bit more happy, they sound a bit more nicer gifts. But the larger significance isn't the death that myrrh points to, it's Jesus' death and resurrection. And it offers us a clean start. That's the gift of myrrh. Jesus didn't die on the cross and stay dead, he rose. He didn't stay wrapped in those cloths that were infused with myrrh. He rose again, defeated sin and death. Last week Andy talked about the gold and how it represents in one way the gift of leadership that Jesus gives to us, the leadership that we can have from him in our lives. We can follow him, we can make him the leader of our lives, we can make him the king of our lives, we can follow his example. But I think we all know that there's times when we get that wrong. As much as we might want to do that, we mess up. We don't follow Jesus. We don't make him leader of our lives. We think, actually, I'd rather be the leader of my life. I've got a better idea about how to do this. I want to go my way. I want to be the captain of my own destiny, however we think about it. But Myrrh offers the solution to this. When we fail to make Jesus the leader of our lives, when we mess up, when we sin, it gives us the chance to have a clean start because of what Jesus did on the cross. Next slide, thank you. And this idea of being made clean is really nicely illustrated in this story from Matthew 8. If you haven't got it open in your pew Bibles, in the church Bibles, you might want to open it, or it's up on the screen as well. Matthew 8, 1 to 4, that was read to us a moment ago. It's a simple story of a leper, a man with leprosy, who comes before Jesus and calls out to Jesus, "Lord, if you are willing, make me clean." And we read that Jesus reaches out and touches the man before saying, "I am willing, be clean." Even before the miraculous healing that then takes place, just the step of reaching out and touching that man would have been significant. Leprosy was a contagious disease. No one wanted to go anywhere near lepers. They were pushed to the edge of society. They were shunned. They were treated as second, third class citizens. They had a tough time. You were considered unclean if you touched someone with leprosy. So Jesus was willing to make himself, Jesus, the perfect Son of God, living as a man on earth, was willing to make himself unclean so the man with leprosy could be made clean. What Jesus did in these verses would have been shocking to anyone watching. You just didn't go anywhere near lepers. So for the man with leprosy, as well as being the significance of him being physically healed, which he was immediately, even better was the fact that Jesus made him spiritually clean. Part of the issue with leprosy, they weren't even allowed into the temple. They weren't even allowed into the place where people celebrated God, where people had at that time a relationship with God before Jesus changed things around. The significance of the fact was that they were unable to have that relationship with God because they were unable to go into the temple. And it goes back to the laws in Leviticus, and you can read about there, it's to do with being ritually unclean. Jesus not only made the man physically clean, he made him spiritually clean. And Jesus then goes and tells him to go off to the priests and get this recognised so that he can then access the temple. Again, fitting in with what the law explained. Leprosy, in this way, is a very visual reminder that we're all covered in a spiritual disease, the spiritual disease of sin. It blocks us our access to the perfect God. However, Jesus makes that relationship. We can have that access to God. Jesus makes us clean by wiping away our sin so we can be right with God. Maybe another way to think about it, the idea of being clean, is a bit like this. When you see something like this, you probably think about it in two ways. One, you might think, oh, Sian had a great time. Sian has been wallowing around in the mud. It looks brilliant. I wish I could be like that. I like to keep myself too clean, whatever it might be. The other side you might think is, no one with any shoes like that is coming anywhere near my car, my house. Go away, clean yourself up. That's disgusting. I can tell from the last which way some people line up. But maybe for a lot of us, when we see this, we think back probably to our childhood, although as adults we still are allowed to wallow in the mud, that's okay. We think back to our childhood and think to a time that we got completely muddy. Maybe it was playing sport at school, maybe we were forced to play rugby or something like that and just got a complete state. Maybe it was we just fell over on the way home, maybe we were messing around with our friends in the woods, whatever it might be. I'm sure we can all think of a time we got in a complete mess, our clothes were in a complete state, and we knew that we probably shouldn't have done. And we go back home, we get back to our house, and we're just about to knock on the door. And even before we turn the handle, there's some sixth sense, I think, that parents have. And we hear from the inside the house, "Stay outside. Don't even think about coming in." Whatever it might be. "Get that muddy clothes off." It depends how patient the parent is. I have this with my son. I go and pick him up from school some days, and he comes back after his football club, and he's covered, he's got all his kit hanging off him, whatever it might be, and I have this thing of, you know, trying to get him in the house in that sort of way, and I'm not so patient, I'm very much a, "Stay outside, don't get anywhere near." Hopefully, what happens next, in a good scenario, we've been told to stay outside, but hopefully, then, the loving parent, mother, father, comes out with cloths, buckets, washing up liquid, hose, whatever it might be needed, and cleans us up. Gives us a good soaking, gives us, sorts us out, whatever it might be. Hopefully that's the way it works. Because you know that a kid who's in that state is not going to be able to clean themselves up. They're not even going to be able to get those boots off without making themselves twice as muddy. They need someone to do it for them. We get scrubbed, we get washed, we get cleaned up, we get clean clothes, whatever it might be. And then we're told, come in. From stay outside to come in. Welcomed in. It's exactly the same for us with God. We can't hope to get into his house, into his presence, in the state we're in, covered in mud, covered in sin. He sent Jesus to die on the cross to sort that out. It gives us a way to be clean before God, to really and fully remove the mud, the sin from us, to give us new clothes, to make us whole again, however we want to think about it, before we're invited to come in. And try as we might, we can't do this ourselves. At best, we could probably push some of the mud around. We can't sort ourselves out. And that's the joy of myrrh. Something that on the first look seems so sad. But the joy of it is that we get told not just to stay outside, but to come in. We get cleaned up. And there's a joy in that, isn't there? That knowing that actually, God, in the reality is, he knows the worst of us. He knows what we do in the moments that no one else sees. He knows the things that we probably struggle to even admit to ourselves sometimes. God knows the worst of us, but he still loves us because he's already cleaned off the dirt. The joy in knowing that we're forgiven, free from condemnation, as the song goes, because of what Jesus did on the cross. For some people here, you might be still to make any sort of decision around following Jesus in your life, to accept the gifts he wants to give you. Myrrh provides a real clear signpost to the great truth that Jesus paid that cost for all of us on the cross. Aside from maybe communion and Easter, we don't always think about it, particularly at Christmas, but myrrh takes us from that thinking about Christmas, putting us in the mindset of what happened at Easter, where Jesus paid that ultimate cost for us. For others, maybe we've already made a decision to follow Jesus in our lives, but myrrh still provides a reminder. We daily need to ask for that forgiveness. We daily need to return to what Jesus did on the cross. In a minute, we're going to have a time of communion, and part of that is we really vividly get to focus on the cross, the non-alcoholic wine and the bread, Jesus' blood and body. Maybe the challenge for us as we go from here, when we leave this service, when we go out into our day-to-day living, is actually, amongst all the things going on at Christmas, this reminder of the cross helps us think, do we really understand the cross? Do we really, day in, day out, understand its significance? Are we living what might be called a cross-shaped life? Because if we really understand what Jesus did on the cross, and we sang about it in so many of these songs this morning, if we really understand the price he paid, what it means for our lives, it should affect how we live our lives. It should affect how we treat other people. We look at how Jesus treated us, how much he paid for us, how much he did for us. That should affect how we treat others. It should affect where we focus our time and our energy. It should affect how we respond when people let us down. We've let God down. We've sinned. How did he respond to us? How should we respond to others who let us down? I guess the challenge from this, or one of the challenges from the idea of myrrh, is to make us be sure that we haven't forgotten what the cross means. Because I think if we forget the significance of the cross, we can forget two things. We can go kind of two extremes. One is that we forget that actually the cross was necessary because God's judgment on sin. We can't get into God's perfect presence in the presence of sin. And ultimately, we have to accept that we have sinned. We might say to ourselves, well, I'm okay. I've never been arrested. I've never done anything so bad I made someone cry, or at least this week. I've never so badly let someone down that it ended a friendship, or whatever it might be. We might say, I haven't done those really terrible things. I'm okay. You know, I'm not perfect, but I don't do really bad things. At least nothing that makes the papers. But really, part of what the cross is showing us is that God's judgment for sin applies to all of us. And it was so extreme, God's response to sin, that he sent his son to die on the cross to sort it out. And the other extreme we can maybe forget is that it's not about what we do. We can forget about grace that's shown through the cross. We sang it in some of these songs at least two or three times this morning. It's the grace of God through what Jesus did that makes this possible for us. We can't earn it. We can't scrub that mud off ourselves. We can't hope to make ourselves clean enough. To finish, I want to read a passage from this book that we've been following this series. It sums this up in a far nicer, poetic and understandable way than I could do. The book says this: we try to remove our mud, but we just move it around. We try to turn away from doing wrong, but it proves too ingrained to avoid it for too long. We try to wash away the bad by doing good, but mud sticks. In our prouder moments, we assume we're good enough. In our more honest ones, we worry that we're not. Deep down, we wonder whether we have cleaned ourselves up sufficiently to be allowed into eternity. The cross says, you haven't, and you can't, and you don't need to. The cross says, you haven't, and you can't, and you don't need to. I pray for all of us, the gift of myrrh, the gift of a clean start, will focus our minds and hearts on what Jesus did for us on the cross and allow us to live a more cross-shaped life. Amen.